भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ग्रंथराज श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 4 चैप्टर 27 वी विल डू टेक्स 15 एंड 16 सो टेक्स 15 द चैप्टर इज कॉल्ड अटैक बाय चंडवेग ऑन द सिटी ऑफ पुरंजन टेक्स्ट 15 ते चंडवेगानुचराः पुरञ्जनपुरं यदा हर्तुम् आरेभिरे तत्र प्रत्याषेधत् प्रजागरः ते चण्डवेगानुचराः पुरञ्जनपुरं यदा हर्तुम् आरेभिरे तत्र प्रत्यषेधत् प्रजागरः ते चण्डवेगानुचराः पुरञ्जनपुरं यदा हर्तुम् आरेभिरे तत्र प्रत्यषेधत् प्रजागरः Ladies, please. Just one among so many. Come on. One more, please. Te, all of them, Chandavega, of Chandavega, Anucharaha, followers, Puranjana, of King Puranjana, Puram, city, Yada, when, Hartum, to plunder, Arebhire began. Tatra there. Pratyashedhat defended. Prajagaraha the big serpent. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jaya. When King Gandharva Raja, that is Chandavega, and his followers began to plunder the city of Puranjana, a snake with five hoods began to defend the city. Purport. When one is sleeping, the life air remains active in different dreams. The five hoods of the snake indicate that the life air is surrounded by five kinds of air known as prana, apana, vyana, udana, and samana. When the body is inactive, the prana or the life air is active. Up to the age of 50, one can actively work for sense gratification. But after the 50th year, one's energy decreases. Although one can with great strain work for 2 or 3 more years, perhaps up to the 55th year. Thus the 55th year is generally taken by government regulations as the final year for retirement. The energy which is fatigued after 50 years is figuratively described herein as the serpent with five hoods. Text 16. Sasaptavishak shatereko vimshatya chasatam samaha puranjana puradhyaksho gandharver yuyude bali. The five-hooded serpent, the superintendent and protector of the city of King Puranjana, fought with the Gandharvas for 100 years. He fought alone with all of them, although they numbered 720. Purport. The 360 days and 360 nights combined to become 720 soldiers of Chandavega time. One has to fight these soldiers throughout one's lifespan, beginning with birth and ending with death. This fight is called the struggle for existence. Despite this struggle, however, the living entity does not die. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, text 20, the living entity is eternal. Na jayate mriyate va kadachin, nayam bhutva bhavita va na bhuyaha, ajo nitya shashvatoyam purano, na hanyate hanyamane sharire. For the soul there is never birth nor death, nor, having once been, does he ever cease to be. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, undying, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Actually, the living entity does not take birth, nor does he die, but he has to fight with the stringent laws of material nature throughout the entire span of his lifetime. He must also face different kinds of miserable conditions. Despite all this, the living entity, due to illusion, thinks that he is well situated in sense gratification. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chaksurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Vishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Swapadantikam Vancha Kalpataru Vyascha Kripa Sindhu Vya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So I'd like to welcome all our young Vaishnavis for their retreat. I believe you've been coming for a few months. I just haven't been here. So it's the first time. It's nice to see all of you. And other guests and visitors who are with us this Saturday. Just before we begin the Bhagavatam class, we recite the translation for the Guru Puja prayer. The prayer is called Guru Vandana, And specifically, we offer our heartfelt feelings to the exalted position of a spiritual master and the potency of the spiritual master's words, meaning instructions, to cut through the illusion of us conditioned souls. And we say that my consciousness must be tamed or refined by the words emanating from his lotus mouth. And he removes the darkness from my heart and fills my heart with transcendental knowledge. So that's the function of a guru. The guru's function is not to become a rubber stamp. The rubber stamp means the disciple can do whatever the disciple wants, but for formality's sake, go to the guru and say, "Is that okay?" And the guru says, "All right, approved." Guru is not a rubber stamp. Guru is the one who's supposed to remove illusion from the heart of the bhakta or bhaktin. And so here, that's what Narada Muni is doing. Narada is playing that role. So when we offer our respects like that to our spiritual master, that means we're offering to the whole Guru Tattva, the Guru Parampara. And Narada Muni, because he's part of our disciplic succession and is such an amazing person, that he knows how to perfectly deal with every disciple. And his disciples range across species, not just across countries, but across species. And he knows how to exactly deal with each one of them. When it came to Nalakuvera and Manigriva, he just punished them. Okay, there's a whole description of his thought process, but he punished them to be trees, standing like that, naked, for tens of thousands of years in the backyard of Nanda Maharaj. When it came to Mrigari the hunter, he gave him transcendental knowledge in a way that he could understand. When it was Ratnakar the dacoit, he told him, chant these syllables, Mara, which is Rama, spoken backwards. Sit under a tree and just recite Mara, Mara, Mara. When it came to other persons, he knew. When it came to Vyasadeva, all he had to do was to chide him and say, what you've done is you've given them a sanction to become more, to dwell deeper into sense gratification, although you've compiled everything. But when it comes to King Prachini Barhishat, he's dealing with him in a very particular manner, because Prachini Barhishat is very attached. And we've been discussing, and I'll narrate so far what the story has been, for those of you who have not been following with us. Prachini Barhishat represents that aspect of us that is very attached. And one of the qualities of being attached is that we cannot hear good advice. It just doesn't enter. So in English there's a phrase, having a bean in the ear. It doesn't matter how many people say it. It doesn't matter how nicely they say it. It just doesn't touch us. And we wonder, maybe it's not for me, maybe it works for them. Because the conviction is, either that my situation is very unique or this is not for me. Or there is too much fear to step out of this condition into a condition of light. Because if I have to go into light, my God, what will happen? So for attached persons, Narada has to narrate a whole story. This is an allegory. And this allegory is to help Narada tell Prachini Barihishat, I'm talking about you. But if he says to him, I'm talking about you, then the part of the attachment is it gets yanked, and so that's painful. In some cases, maybe necessary, and Narada has done that. Depends on the condition of his disciple. Vyasadeva was not attached. So it was easy to say to Vyasadeva, what have you done? But Prachini Barishat is too attached. So he has to very gently remove that attachment. So he narrates this allegory. The allegory is that there is a king called Puranjana, which is, and I'm going to narrate what's the parallel here. Puranjana means the conditioned living entity. And Puranjana inhabits, or is a king of a city called Panchala. That means he inherits a body of five senses. And this body has nine gates, right? So all of you have done the Bhagavad Gita drama of City of Nine Gates by Bhaktimarga Maharaj. So there are nine gates to this body: two eyes, two nostrils, one mouth, two ears, the anus and genitals. So that's nine. So sitting in this kingdom called Panchala, he's thinking, I am the ruler, I am the king. And he has a very attractive wife. In this story, her name is Puranjani. And that's indicated as one's intelligence. And depending on how one utilizes one's intelligence, one does or does not do certain kinds of activities. So the intelligence is supposed to protect us, to guide us, to elevate us for performing Krishna conscious activities. But depending upon which mode of nature we are influenced by, the intelligence will give us the direction to do mode of ignorance activities, or mode of passion activities, or mode of goodness activities. It's like how one interacts with one's wife. If one is, however the wife directs the husband. In this case, it is the intelligence. And King Prachini Barihishat, although a pious man, is very attached to sense gratification. So there's a description of how he lies down on the hand of his wife and uses it like a pillow and gazes into her beautiful face and says all these sweet nothings. And together they have 1,100 sons and 110 daughters. Each of those sons and daughters in turn have many, many sons and daughters. And his whole kingdom becomes overpopulated with children and grandchildren. Imagine his breakfast table. These activities, the sons and grandsons, are described as pious or impious activities that we perform using our intelligence. So the product of utilizing the intelligence is activities. So King Puranjana has performed all these so-called pious activities. And now, because we're in the material world, we're influenced by time. So in this story, time is represented by Sriman Chandavega. The word Chandavega, it describes, Prabhupada teaches us, means that which acts very swiftly. So time acts very swiftly, it also acts very imperceptibly. So every conditioned living entity who's residing in Panchala Desha is influenced by time or attacked by time. Therefore we have old age and disease and all of our karmic activities sprouting for us. And Chandavega comes with, he's a Gandharva Raja. Gandharva, Prabhupada described in yesterday's purport, Gandharva also means those that are not easily visible or imperceptible. So he has soldiers. He has 360 male soldiers and 360 female soldiers. And they all attack King Puranjana's kingdom. The 360 male soldiers are compared to the days of a year. The 360 female soldiers are compared to the nights of a year. And these 720, as we read today, constantly attack or plunder the kingdom of King Puranjana. That means one's life is constantly taken away by the agents of time, called day and night. By the rising of the sun, that was the verse in the Bhagavatam that we read 2 days ago. By the rising of the sun and by the setting of the sun, a conditioned living entity does not understand that his life is being taken away. He's thinking, another day for sense gratification, another day to look forward to working very hard, another day to work towards fulfilling my dream. Ishwaroham aham bhogi siddoham balavan sukhi. Every new day is a great opportunity to advance in my dreams of conquering whatever, or advancing in my fulfillment of my sense gratification dreams and aspirations that I have. But the Bhagavatam tells us that's the trick of time. By the bright rising of the sun, when everything looks so wonderful, it's actually taking our life away. Because by each passing day, we're one day closer to death. And the interesting thing is, nobody knows when their death is. Except in some very great special cases, there's a little tap on the shoulder that says, time's up. But for most persons, we don't know. So the conditioned living entity is compared to a foolish animal sometimes. Prabhupada would narrate this, that there is a line of goats at a slaughterhouse, and a goat is being slaughtered, and the very next goat whose turn is coming up is oblivious. He's just busy nibbling at the grass. Doesn't even if the fellow right next to him is being killed, he doesn't understand, this is my next is my turn. Because there is some green grass, he's just happy nibbling at it. He's considered to be unintelligent. That doesn't awaken to the impending danger that life is just moving away, or moving along. So the words of the spiritual master to awaken us from such slumber. The two types of slumber. One is the primordial slumber. Primordial slumber means the living entity in illusion is not awake to Krishna consciousness. And the other slumber is, despite knowing that, dozing off in Bhagavatam class. That's the second type of slumber. Both are dangerous, and so the words of the guru are to awaken that. So when we read the story of Chandavega and King Puranjana, it's an exciting story, honestly. It's really nice the way Narada Muni is describing it, but it's more than entertainment. It is to awaken us as the readers of Bhagavatam. So when Chandavega attacks with his 720 soldiers, Hartum arebhire tatra pratyashedhat prajagaraha. What comes to defense is this serpent, the five-hooded serpent. This five-hooded serpent is the energy that we have, the bodily strength, the ability to sustain an onslaught. And it has five hoods because there are these, they're called the life airs. Prana, Apana, Vyana, Udara, and Samana. There are 10 kinds of airs in the body, or 5 pairs of airs. Prana is the one that we inhale and exhale. Vyana is what happens inside. Udana is the other inter-bodily spatial air. The airs that we leave through our body. They're all varieties of airs, and all of these are necessary to keep the soul within the body. And are depending on what activity a living entity is performing, different pairs of airs become activated. And within those airs, or by those airs, the living entity can perform certain activities. If there was not sufficient air in someone's body, or there was blockages, then one has stiff joints, or you know, they become tight. If one has, the prana is not working well, one cannot breathe, severe respiratory issues. If someone has severe indigestion, then the other, that air that has to, supposed to leave the body, doesn't leave and creates all sorts of inconvenience. So these 5 airs, they actually try to help us survive within this material world. So when time attacks, there has to be a response. The response is this, that we have to live within this material world. There is winter, there is summer, there is the whole idea of sitting in traffic and getting to work. Every human being has to do all these activities. From the time they wake up, they have to perform certain activities of cleaning the body. It's like taking care of a car, actually. You clean the body, it's called brushing the teeth, you know, then evacuating all the waste material, taking a bath, decorating it, perfuming it. And then we use the body for different activities, manipulating, putting things together, breaking things apart, right? You have a vegetable, you have to break it apart, you have to cut it down. And you put multiple vegetables and you bring it all together to make some item to eat. We have to lift weights, you have to carry this backpack, briefcase, some weight. Then we have to use the mind and intelligence and work our fingers or hands and legs at working on something. So we are expending that energy. This is just for the purpose of meeting or fulfilling our material desires. So the point is that within this material world, the fulfillment of our material desires comes at a price. The price is that we have to spend our energy. And because the body is a machine, we don't have unlimited energy. That energy exhausts after 50 years. Prabhupada says maximum 55. So for every person, the intelligence is to be conservative. Can you turn down the mic? Is this so much background feedback? The real intelligence is to conserve one's energy and use it over a long period of time. There's a difference between somebody who runs a 100-meter dash and one who runs a marathon. The one who runs a 100-meter dash has to have a burst of energy and spend all of that in 10 seconds. Carl Lewis would make it in 9.4 or 9.6. But one who runs a marathon cannot run like that. If somebody runs a marathon at 100 meters per 9.5 seconds, fellow won't see beyond a mile. He'll be dying or he'll be dead. So life is like this long stretch. It's a marathon. But heavy sense gratification means running a marathon at 100 meters per 9.4 seconds or something. Naturally, one will get exhausted. So conservative idea is to expend energy in activities that don't have to exhaust us like this. In another lecture, Prabhupada describes how the yogis conserve their life. It is also said that each person has a number of breaths determined already. That's what determines how long a person will live. And if you spend all your breaths early, then you don't have enough. That means death comes earlier. If somebody conserves their breathing, then they can live longer. So the yogis perfect the breathing technique, and they know how to hold their breath for a long time. And that's why they live very long years. Prabhupada says some of them live 200, 300 years. And then Prabhupada says, but a materialist will spend all his breath in sex with his, all his heavy breathing, and so he dies soon. But sense gratification means heavy breathing, because there's so much heavy activity just to extract the so-called happiness. And so this five-hooded snake for such a person is exhausted very soon. And as the story goes on, we'll see how this five-hooded serpent is being attacked constantly by these 720 soldiers. And the fellow becomes weak. He cannot fight anymore. And so when old age comes, they don't have the opportunity or the time to make good use of it. Because this, the five-hooded serpent that we have, the bodily energy, gets beat up so bad that just cannot make it. So the last years of life are spent in just recovering from disease, either in hospitals or someplace just completely debilitated. Therefore, such education begins when a person is young, so that they understand, whoa, I have so much energy that I've got to take it all through life. And I should live a conservative life, or conservative in the sense I know how to conserve my energy, use my energy in very intelligent activities, not unintelligent activities. Ugra karma, as Prabhupada would say, heavy passionate activities, meaning everyday selfish activities, simply for the sense gratification of this body. The five-hooded serpent will become very weak. And the illusion is that the soul neither is born nor does he die. So he doesn't need to struggle for existing. By nature he is existing. But the material energy puts on this whole illusion, this drama, that unless you work hard, you cannot survive. Unless you gather all these things in your life, there is no fun. Unless you stick on you all these medals of this certificate, this education, that degree, this much money, so many friends and so many people to glorify you, unless this happens, your life's wasted. Oh, okay. Here I go. I'll work hard. Prabhupada says one should work hard for sense, for self-realization. So what people do is they work hard for sense gratification and hardly work for self-realization. Nothing is done. But they don't have the time. Or their five-hooded serpent is just tired after a whole day's worth of work. So one of the ways to excite the five-hooded serpent is, Prabhupada narrates in the previous purport, sexual activity. That's like an incentive. Yeah, good job. Yeah, here you go. And with that excitement of sex, next day says, I'm ready for another day. Silly. So this word is struggle for material existence. In the Bhagavad Gita, that phrase is called Karshati. The all blissful soul. Sat, Chit, Ananda. is put into this asat, achit, nirananda body and is told, work very hard. And he thinks, yes, yes, I have to. Come on, there's so many things I have to do. And he struggles with his mind and his senses. Manas shashtani indriyani. The mind and the five senses, combined six senses. Manas shashtani indriyani. Prakriti sthani karshati. Is situated in this material world and he struggles for his existence. There's a constant struggle. The Bhagavatam is telling us that we don't need to struggle like that. It is worthwhile to struggle for serving Krishna. So that motivation must be clear. Why am I struggling? If at the end of all my struggle, all I'm going to get is a dead snake, the energy is all spent, and my body is going to be anyway plundered, and King Puranjan is going to lose, it's not worth it. And he's defending his kingdom because he's thinking, it is my kingdom, my body, this is mine. Despite all this, the living entity, due to illusion, thinks that he is well situated in sense gratification. He thinks everything is fine. Hey, it's worth it. It's not so bad after all, because I am getting something out of it. I am getting money, I am getting friends, I am getting something that I can hold on to or hold up to as value. That's the illusion. One time Prabhupada narrates I heard one devotee narrate the law of karma. And he was saying that there were two warriors. One was on the side of India, the other guy was on the side of Pakistan, and they were fighting this war at the border. And the Indian soldier gets up, and in his heart is full of hatred for the Pakistani soldier, and he's thinking, this Pakistani, and he gets up and gets shot. And so, yam yam vapi smaran bhavan, whatever state of consciousness you leave your body, the next body is similar. So because he was thinking about Pakistani, in his next life he's born on the other side of the border. And then he gets trained up as a soldier, and in this life now he's fighting the Indian soldiers. Oh, these Indians. He gets shot, he dies, and he's born on this side of the border. Again trains up into military and is fighting them. It's the same soul, just on this side and that side of the border. But in that life he's thinking, oh, they are my enemy. My enemies. Then the very next life he's thinking, oh, these are my enemies. The very same persons that he fought with, now he's fighting against. So Prabhupada says he must also face different kinds of miserable conditions. So there are three miserable conditions called Adhyatmika Klesha, Adibhautika Klesha, and Adidaivika Klesha. Klesha means misery. Adhyatmika Klesha means struggle by one's own body and mind. That's called Brahmacharya Ashram. And there is Adibhautika, it's a joke, please. And there is Adibhautika Klesha, struggle due to someone else's body and mind. That's called Grahastha Ashram. And then there is Adidaivika Klesha, misery due to higher authority. That's called temple life. So a person has to constantly face these three difficulties. And just for preserving the body. But the law of material nature is such that the material body cannot be preserved. Even if you pickle it, do whatever it takes, it cannot be preserved. So some people mummify the body to preserve it, but the soul cannot stay in it. So preservation of something is without the soul in it has no value. because the law of nature will not allow the soul to exist in the body beyond its scheduled time. And the body has to deteriorate, has to. So the intelligent human being is meant to study King Puranjana's story and utilize human life for the real pursuit of Krishna consciousness. Do not waste any time or conduct any spurious or wasteful activities. Okay, some questions, comments, thoughts, something? You want to? Okay. Anything from here? Yes, Jai Jagannath Prabhu.
Based on what we're hearing in your class, we may feel like why I should expend so much of my energy in this way when I need to be really taking time out to cultivate, you know, let's say my bhajan and my absorption in Krishna Katha, etc. So then we may think that these too many activities are quite superfluous and unnecessary for me to be involved in.
Right.
Maybe that was good in the very outset of my Krishna consciousness. Now I'm at a certain point. And it seems there could be some validity to that for certain devotees also. So I was wanting to know, how do we understand when, even within the Krishna conscious arena, how some activities may be unnecessarily expending our energy when there should be, our absorption should be somewhere else, and where we should be actually really engaged, like that kind of, you know, how do we understand, how can we make that distinction?
An activity by itself cannot be determined as wasteful or useful unless the motivation behind it is wasteful or useful. So the purpose, the motivation should be clear. It's for the pleasure of Kishore Kishori, let's say, for the pleasure of Krishna. Then a seemingly wasteful activity that expends bodily energy may not be that. For example, let's say someone has to carry out the garbage from the temple to the dumpster. Okay, seemingly wasteful activity that has to carry weight and go there. But the motivation is that this is to keep Kishore Kishori's temple clean. That's a useful activity. In fact, it is devotional service. It may be something else, fixing this, doing that, or for that matter, you know, and then the flip side of it is, one may be doing so-called devotional activities, but the reason for doing it may be completely different. That may be a wasteful activity, in the sense that it won't give the real satisfaction to the heart. Suppose I sit there and study all day without doing anything, just to impress others. Everyone should see, oh, studying so nicely, or oh, he is traveling so much, or whatever is different person's, then it's wasteful activity because Krishna is not impressed by it. So an activity is useful or wasteful, the benchmark for it or the yardstick for it is how much it pleases Krishna. And what pleases Krishna, my understanding, is not just the activity, but how the activity is conducted under the auspices of, let's say, our founder Acharya. What's coming to mind is, there was one young man who, in Mayapur, decided to chant 100 rounds or 125 rounds a day or something. And so he was living on a tree and chanting 125 rounds. Well, so chanting is definitely pleasing to Krishna. So all the other devotees were also pretty impressed, and Prabhupada was on a morning walk and they said, Prabhupada, he chants 100 rounds, sitting up on a tree, very renounced, and chanting all day. The Prabhupada said, what practical service has he done for Krishna? What is the use of it, or something? Not that chanting is not useful. What's the practical use of it, or something like that? So an activity is pleasing to Krishna, but the real pleasure is how it is performed in conjunction with the others that are also serving Krishna. For me, this is a very topic, very close to my heart. So I have a bias towards it, and I'll openly admit, I have a bias towards how we cooperatively work together. So naturally, I'll speak like that. But to me, that's what seems like an useful or valuable activity is on that basis, because that's what brings pleasure to Krishna. What brings pleasure to Krishna is how we're all together serving Krishna. Individually, we may be fantastic, but if collectively we are not so fantastic, then it's not pleasing. You know the story of a person had so many sons and he was tired, so they all decided to massage him. And one son was massaging the father's feet, another was massaging the legs, another was massaging the back, and some other son was massaging the chest, and one was massaging the head. And they were all doing nicely, but they become competitive with each other. So the one son was massaging the feet really strongly. So the son who was massaging the neck decided, I need to do this stronger than my brother. But that's not what is necessary. So it's how cooperatively that we know how to fit in with each other. That's pleasing to Krishna. That is my sense of it. Yeah.
So we know part of cooperating together also is an individual effort.
Absolutely.
And I'll be real. Like, I get concerned sometimes seeing our senior devotees. And, you know, they're quite elderly, many of them. And they're really pushing themselves for the service of Srila Prabhupada, etc. And they're great souls, so I'm not going to even think about trying to imitate that.
Right.
So I'm sometimes wondering about, as I'm getting older in Krishna consciousness, how do I understand when I need to just take a break in a certain area and focus in another area, you know, so that I continue strongly in the cooperative effort to serve Krishna?
Yes. My sense, some of them don't glaze your eyes. This is important for each one of us, so I'll try to keep it relevant. One of the reasons our leaders, my understanding of it, and my understanding is just a, you know, little silo picture of things. One of the reasons that our leaders today are expending so much energy is that our movement has grown like anything. In 50 years, which is coming up soon, we have doubled or quadrupled. So one devotee was doing some research and he looked at Catholicism, looked at Islam, and looked at how they did in their first 50 years of existence. So after Jesus, 50 years later, the whole Christian religion was less than half. It had not grown. It only grew after that. And today it's humongous. In the first 50 years, it didn't grow like that. Islam, first 50 years, was not stellar. So they were looking at different religions, and one of the observations is, you look at ISKCON. In the first 50 years, this is just like mushroomed. It's a good thing. Along with that comes a whole set of people who are really gung-ho, enthusiastic, but not directed. And when they're not directed, they're not properly trained, then they do things that requires our leaders to really jump in to fix it. So there's a positive growth issue, which is nice. The second is a bunch of problems that also come with it. because untrained, not fully pure persons also, you know, join along. So I've heard, right? You've heard too, that our GBC, who are all these sannyasis and, you know, exalted souls, they spend almost 75 to 80% of their time discussing and fixing problems rather than, you know, guiding the organization in a, you know, direction. That so they're making efforts to change that. It boils down to individually for all of us to take on the individual responsibility for cultivating purity, because we're part of a bigger fabric, whether we like it or not. The moment I put on Vaishnav dress, put on tilak with the japa mala and say Namam Vishnu Padaya and chant Prabhupada's Pranati Mantra, oh, we are part of that movement. And how I behave and do things has such an serious impact on the entire society. I may be minuscule, but the impact is big. So yes, individually we need to do things that are strength-giving for us, becoming pure. So the cooperative spirit is not that we lose our identity or individuality. It is that we do things that are necessary for our nourishment in relation to, in communication with the others who are impacted by us. Whether it's in a family unit, temple unit, community unit, society, institution unit. It has some ramification depending on where we are and who we are in the big fabric of things. So I haven't been coming in the morning for the past 2 days. And there's a reason. And so I shared with all of you. My wife's on the altar, so I have to be at home. And when she leaves the temple, I enter the temple. That's how we get things managed, for example. Now, if I don't communicate, I don't say anything to anybody, I just come and go as I please, then I'm not being accountable to the devotees I'm serving. Although it's good for me, let's say, I'm actually taking care of my health, or I'm taking care of Krishna consciousness, studying, whatever it is. But if it is done without that piece of, I'll say, communication, then it shakes things. Do you want to add something? Yeah, Himanshu. Yeah.
You were talking about just the insatiable desire for sense gratification that, mm-hmm, you know, makes the living entity very frustrated in the material world. I was thinking about Nectar of Devotion in the third chapter. Prabhupada says that even if one doesn't have, even if one hasn't fully given up his attraction to, you know, sense gratification and has a lot of material desires, if he can simply develop some attraction for hearing about Krishna, then that would be very powerful.
Correct.
So I was thinking about, you know, as aspiring devotees, we may sometimes feel like, well, I don't have a lot of taste for hearing. I fall asleep, or I don't fully understand the matter, so let me just do a lot of other services. But it seems like if we have that attitude, then we're missing something very important, because of course the services are also purifying us, but it's actually that attraction to hearing that's going to work a lot faster. Or at least that's the way it seems. So anyways, maybe you could speak a little bit about that, so we don't discount one to emphasize the other, nor...
Well, all of our activities are meant to awaken an attraction for hearing Krishna Katha. Dharma sanushtita pumsam vishvaksena katha suyaha. But if our activities don't awaken that, na utpada yadi ratim, if for some reason, let's say I'm doing the service of cleaning, or I'm doing the service of cooking, I'm even doing the service of deity worship, but it's not awakening in me the attraction to learn more about Krishna, how Krishna interacts with his devotees, how Krishna gives his mercy, how sweet Krishna is, how merciful, how forgiving. If I don't have that attraction to hearing from those who have that understanding about Krishna, then it is said that all my activities are shrama, just a useless expenditure of labor. Shrama eva hi kevalam. Although I might do those things nicely. So our life is hearing. Hearing is a big topic, but that hearing is supposed to impel the mood of serving Krishna favorably. Anukulena Krishna Anushilanam. And that part of the favorable service is in conjunction with others. So hearing is the cultivation of hearing. So I may not understand. It doesn't matter. I may be falling asleep. It doesn't matter. But I, in my heart, I am there. I'm there for hearing. During Prabhupada's time in San Francisco, when Jayananda Prabhu was the temple president, all the devotees were working very hard. And Jayananda Prabhu was working doubly hard. One of the things was Jayananda Prabhu did not understand that one round of japa means from this beat to this beat. He thought it was this way and back. So every day he was chanting 32 rounds thinking I'm chanting 16, and he wondered, what's wrong with me? They're all done in half the time. Something's wrong with me. And he would pick the garbage, he would drive taxi during the night, and whatever money came from the cab, you know, he just gave it to the temple, every penny of it. So he was working double shift, chanting 32 rounds, and he would come back during Bhagavatam class and sit there, and as soon as Prabhupada would start speaking, you'd... So someone said to, you know, he's falling asleep. Prabhupada said, no, he's working very hard for Krishna. Although body is sleeping, the soul is hearing. Don't worry. Okay, that's not an excuse for us. Prabhu, my soul was hearing. Okay, repeat everything you heard. Prabhupada gave him that because he knew how sincerely he was working for Krishna. And that attraction was there, that despite all that late night work, all that, he still came. He never missed class, although he fell asleep. So that's what Krishna sees. I was hearing yesterday that initially when we're just starting off and we give a little to Krishna, Krishna sees what we are giving. And he's very happy. And as we grow in our Krishna consciousness and we make commitments to Krishna and we say, my relationship with you has been established, and then we give a little, then Krishna sees what we are holding back. But you can do more, but you're holding back. Not do more in terms of just quality of things. Okay. Final question, will Sri Gauranga Prabhu? There's a question online. Whew. Did they tell their name?
ID. It says KRS0731, not the name.
Online Hare Krishna.
So the question reads, I read somewhere that Krishna can prolong one's life so that he or she may become more Krishna conscious. Full
Correct.
Stop. Doesn't this contradict what was said about having so many breaths of life?
Correct. Good question. Thank you for asking that. We are talking about the normal karmic makeup of life. We're not talking about Krishna's intervention. Krishna's intervention is a whole different paradigm, that Krishna can do anything. Of course, that's what makes him God. So we're talking that in the course of the life of a conditioned soul, Krishna doesn't intervene. So when Krishna intervenes, there's a whole different modality of activities. The case in point is two. One is Mahabharata war. Arjuna was fighting Karna. And Karna had left released the Nagastra, which is like probably one of the most powerful weapons. And that weapon has accuracy that it can never match any other, no other weapon can match that accuracy. And he had very intentionally released it to cut off Arjuna's head. But But Krishna at the right moment, with his big toe, pressed the chariot down. So the whole chariot went down a little bit and the Nagastra knocked off Arjuna's crown. But nothing happened to Arjuna because Krishna intervened. I've been reading the story of Ajamila. The whole book is called The Second Chance. Ajamila is ready to die. The Yamadutas have come to extract his subtle body. So karmically he's done. Once anyone sees the Yamaduta, means it's done. And not one, three of them showed up. But he chanted Narayana. That took calling his son. And the Vishnu Dutas appear and they say, oh, hold on. And so he's given another chance. Go to Haridwar, purify yourself, and then go to Vaikuntha. So we were not referring to Krishna's intervention. We're just talking karmically how it is designed, that everyone's life is determined. When Krishna's intervention happens, anything can change. No such rules. The material laws do not apply in the life of a person when there is Krishna's intervention. Otherwise, the laws of material nature are insurmountable. Daivi hiyesha gunamai mama maya duratyaya. Mameva ye prapadyante maya metam tarantite. That's what we meant. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.